Good morning, and thank you for coming to the Ethics of Whistleblowing. I want to thank Bayit Adult Education for not only co-sponsoring the program, but for actually pushing for this program to exist at all. I've been doing business ethics classes at different accounting firms for, quite a few years, mostly at Zeifman's, Schwartz, Levitsky, Feldman, Miller, Bernstein. But I hadn't done it here until Elaine said to me, you know, we have accountants here and we have people who are interested here, and pushed for us to do that here. So we'll see. If there's interest, then we can certainly have sessions here as well. I happen to think that having sessions over lunch is, like we do with the accounting firms, is better. But for those who want to do it on a Sunday morning, that's an option as well. I do have sign-in sheets over in the middle, or now I'm not sure exactly where they are. Okay, they're still over there. If you want to get a certificate saying that you were here at the program, please make sure that you sign in. If you want information about future business ethics programs, also make sure you sign in. The third column on the sheet, the end column, is only if you want to receive email about general programs. Okay, that's all right. Hopefully people have signed in. If you happen to have a cell phone for some reason, people tend to. If you could put it on silent, that would be wonderful. Final note of introduction is just that nothing I say should be taken as practical, either rabbinic advice or accounting advice. Yes, I am a rabbi, but I refer people to halachic authorities who run shuls, as a general rule, to answer practical questions. And I'm not an accountant at all, so I certainly don't want to pose as one. Our topic is indeed whistleblowing, and I want to break it down into a couple of different parts: whistleblowing in general, as well as anonymous whistleblowing, which poses its own challenges. If you take a look at the first source, this is sort of a classic case at this point, unfortunately. The explosion of the shuttle Challenger back in 1985, and the fact that it was traced to a problem with the O-rings on the Challenger. And in fact, there was an engineer who's mentioned here, Roger Boisjoli, who had actually noticed the problem in advance, tried to call people's attention to it unsuccessfully. Take a look at this from the scientist. When the shuttle Challenger blew up, the explosion lit a fuse in Roger Boisjoli's conscience. A structural engineer for Morton Thiokol Incorporated, the firm that later bore blame for the disaster, Boisjoli had argued against the launch the night before, and like the rest of the nation, watched in horror when the shuttle blew up. I left the room, went directly to my office, where I remained in shock the rest of the day, he recalls about that terrible morning 4 years ago this week. During the next 8 months, Boisjoli would become both a national hero and a professional pariah. So, yeah, I can't even imagine what that feels like for him, knowing that he had called, he had called attention to it, but he had only called attention to it within the firm. He had not gone outside the firm. He had not engaged in what we would call external whistleblowing. And so the question you have to ask when you read this is, did he do what he was supposed to do? What would you say? Did he do enough? And it's not really fair to do it in retrospect and say, well, obviously not. But from an ethical standpoint, in terms of what should be done, did he do enough by calling attention to it within the firm? Yeah. Right. No, so there is more detail about what he knew and when he said and to whom he said it. But the night before, there's apparently a chain of communications that about it. Yeah. Mary?
My reaction is yes. He did do what if he brought it to the attention of, let's say, senior people in his firm, then maybe it would have been irresponsible for him to have gone out of that and gone to another layer.
Good. Expand on that. Why would it be irresponsible, potentially?
Maybe he might have felt that everything isn't okay. He goes to the firm, and maybe more intelligent heads than him could have put, it's okay. I mean, every time he thinks something is wrong, it isn't always wrong. I mean, here it was. if we start to be alarmist and bring it out into the media, causing a lot of harm.
Right. So there's a major distinction to be made between internal whistleblowing and external whistleblowing. And there is a discomfort with the idea of going outside of the business, if only because, as Miriam notes, you might get it wrong. And you can cause significant problems for the firm, for people's jobs, public relations, obviously, if you start telling the world that that something is wrong. And in fact, nothing is wrong. You just misunderstood. So there is that concern, and we're definitely going to have to talk about that more. I mean, the cases that accountants come across tend to be somewhat less dramatic. But I think that the lessons from cases like this one, such as regarding the question of do you go outside the firm, I think do apply. And I think that's something we need to explore. Paul?
I'm just wondering at what point the onus shifts to the firm once they've been told. So, I mean, they haven't done their due diligence. About. I don't know what their response was to this whistleblower.
And the response more or less was to poo-poo it. Meaning there's a lot that's been written about this case. If you go online, if you Google the case, you'll find out more.
Do they have a reason to poo-poo, or do they just say, leave us alone? Like, I mean, were they able to say, no, it's not a problem because of this
right.
and that?
So since it's been a couple of years since I looked at the ins and outs, I'm not going to say, but I'll tell you that it's a case where there's a lot of literature on, and you could see. The other question, though, that I noted in the beginning is not just the question of reporting externally, but also the question of anonymous whistleblowing. Now, the truth of the matter is that in 2020, it's pretty hard to and report anything anonymously. Everything is traceable, whether you're talking about online communications, whether you're talking about an envelope slipped under someone's door. It's not like there aren't security cameras, in the hallway. It's pretty hard to report something anonymously in our day unless you actually create a mechanism. Meaning, if a mechanism is created that enables something to be truly anonymous, then perhaps it can be sustained, or you have one person, an ombudsman of some sort, who is aware, and nobody else is going to be aware. Then it may become a possibility. Take a look at source number 2, which is a proposed law that was put before the Spanish Parliament in June 2018. I don't think this actually passed. It went through a bunch of versions, as laws do. But I brought you the original Spanish for those who enjoy the original Spanish, just because I always include the Hebrew and the English. So I figured, all right, it's the Spanish and the English. But also because the translation here is from Google Translate. If anyone notices anything that looks odd, let me know. All complaints that show a minimum appearance of truth will be admitted. Anonymous complaints will not be processed, nor will those that cannot be supported by documents or contrasted information. So anonymous complaints will not be accepted. Why would anonymous whistleblowing not be accepted?
Because they could be personal vendettas.
Yes, indeed.
They can be personal, right? You're just trying to hide your involvement by shielding your name, but that's what's in fact behind it.
Causing harm, and that's the only intent, and you don't want it to come back to you as to where the harm started.
Interesting. The idea that could be an attempt at just to cause harm without anything else. It's not necessarily, though. I mean, people might be anonymous just because they want protection. Meaning, I'm not going to be discussing this morning, we're doing this for an hour, not for five, the issue of legislation to protect whistleblowers. That's really its own conversation. But we know, and look in the media, it doesn't always work.
I actually reminded of a story back in the 80s, under, I think around 20 years ago, where Masalek Kilushin was doing 3 weddings that morning, got an anonymous phone call early in the morning saying, "What one of the colors that you're wearing isn't Jewish."
Mm-hmm. Did they say which one? Or they just...
No, they didn't. Oh. They didn't.
Seriously?
They did not.
It's like a game. It's like a game show.
You have to do a whole Hakira, etc.
Wow. That strikes me as a little odd. Miriam?
So it's too easy to send out something anonymous. You could be doing it, whether it's emotionally or that enough proof. It's not rigorous enough.
Right. There's a low bar when you won't put your name behind it.
Yeah.
That's certainly a concern. Another concern.
How do you drill down if you don't know who made the complaint? To get more information or facts behind it.
Right, it becomes very hard to investigate an anonymous complaint. And again, unless you're working with the ombudsman type case where there's just a barrier between the investigators and the party who's reporting it so the communications can go back and forth, then maybe you have some hope. But otherwise, you're just dropping a bomb somewhere and leaving.
Well, it depends how specific the information.
Right. It depends how good the intel is. That's true.
Because you tend to, you know, the company or whatever will tend to do an investigation about who is the whistleblower as opposed to what was actually wrong.
Fair.
The thing is, in this case, if somebody's very, very specific and has technical arguments or really in-depth technical issues,
right.
I think that's something which you can take more seriously even though it is an anonymous whistleblower.
True. Jake?
I think there's two different kinds of kind of anonymous complaints that we're talking about. Sometimes there's whistleblowing, and sometimes, I mean, police rely on anonymous tips all the time. So if you didn't have anonymous tips, a lot of these investigations that lead to revelations of corruption wouldn't even begin. I think that there's a distinction to be made between anonymous tips that are done just to create chaos out of personal vendetta, mm-hmm. versus, you know, when it's a legit anonymous tip, and you like that, where there is underlying evidence, but maybe that's without that anonymous tip, nobody would even think to look for it.
Right. So I definitely want to make that distinction between the one that's just personal and the one that's that tips off the police. I was looking to see if I put it on here, but I see I did not. One of the fellows whose work I read a lot of in preparing this, a fellow by the name of Sandy Boucher, who's from, I think it was Halifax. He's an investigator of whistleblowing complaints with decades of experience in police investigations as well as legal investigations. And he commented and gave statistics that whistleblowers are indeed the most common way that things like these are found, well beyond internal audits. And it's logical, because as he points out, the best way to get information is by an insider handing it to you. So that's certainly the case.
Watergate would never have happened without whistleblowers.
Right. And that's the last of the political ones that I'm going to go into. The questions that we want to look at are, what is whistleblowing? What affects the decision to blow the whistle, whether within CPA Ontario or within Halakha, Jewish law? And is anonymous whistleblowing appropriate? So in terms of defining whistleblowing, it generally is understood to have three key components. Number one, it's external. External meaning that you're going outside the normal chain of command and the parties who are directly involved. It's not whistleblowing if I think somebody is doing something wrong and I go to him and say, hey, what you're doing is wrong. That's not whistleblowing. There's no whistleblown. You're going outside the chain of command and often outside of the company altogether. So that's number one. Number two, it's done to protect a victim. Meaning, there's a vulnerable party who stands to be harmed by whatever it is that's being done that is wrong, and you're going to go outside the chain of command in order to protect that vulnerable party. And third, it's done in a way that can lead to change. It's not random. It's not done just to be sensational, but it actually has the capacity to change things. And you'll see where I'm getting this from, these three steps. But the question of what sort of wrongdoing, what sort of harm justifies whistleblowing is actually subject to debate. For example, what if it's wrongdoing that is unintentional? What if wrongdoing is going on that is unintentional? But would not be corrected just because you pointed it out to the person involved. Let's say you have somebody who's simply inept. Right? They're inept at what they're doing, and when you point out the problem, they don't recognize that there is even a problem. So does that justify going outside the chain of command and potentially outside of the company altogether? Miriam says yes.
Yeah. Once you pointed it out, and they're not going to fix it, this unintentionality sort of changes, because it sounds like unintentional seems like an accident. You're doing this the wrong way, it sort of becomes a little bit more intentional. It's the action.
Okay. Other thoughts on that?
I mean, it depends how far up you go. I mean, the question is whether have they exhausted all the people who actually could have an impact on either the behavior of that person, that inept person, within the corporate structure before you start going outside.
Well, I'm going to come back to the following later, but I want to note, it's not true that the only options that you have are telling the person involved or telling, outside of the chain of command. Another option, which CPA Ontario frequently recommends, is simply leaving.
Leaving the firm?
Leaving the client. Well, it depends on what your engagement is. Are you an employee of the company, or are you an outsider who's, you know, doing work for the company? They talk specifically about the case of leaving the engagement, saying that the if, you know, this isn't going to be corrected, I went up the chain of command already and I got nowhere, then you simply walk away, as opposed to suggesting that you start reporting it beyond the firm. So it's something that's worth considering. We're going to come back to that because I want to show you the guidance that you get from CPI Ontario on this point. Miriam?
When you talk about there's a victim, can the victim be the Canadian taxpayers, like something as big and...
You bet. Absolutely. And that was part of my next question, which is, what if wrongdoing really only harms the company itself? This person who is either inept or is embezzling from the company, whatever it is, the products are being produced, the services are being rendered, the customer is not necessarily being harmed in any way, shape, or form, but something's wrong within the company itself. It's a private company. There are no outside public shareholders who are being defrauded. It's just a matter of the owners of the company are the ones who are suffering. So the question now is, does that justify going outside the chain of command and even going outside the company to report it?
Why wouldn't you just tell the owners if, let's say, the bookkeeper was doing something wrong with them?
What if it's the owner? We'll get to a case like that.
The owner's hurting a partner? Like
The owner's taking money from the company. I mean, inappropriately.
The partner that's being hurt that doesn't know that? Is that
yeah, or it's right? going to damage the viability of the company long term.
Then it hurts the employees potentially.
So then it potentially hurts the employees. So my question is, are you justified in going outside of the company?
I think there should be a hierarchy. I mean, there's certain, before heading outside, and so we say airing the...
So there's unquestionably a hierarchy, we'll have to talk about that. Let me show you something here. There's a very broad approach taken in number three by the CSA group. Now, the CSA group, if I remember correctly, is engaged in marketing whistleblowing systems and such, and they're a little bit broad, I think, in their definition of what exactly justifies whistleblowing. In number three on your sheets. If you take a look at item B, the types of misconduct reported may range from ineptitude to mismanagement to illegality, unethical conduct, or any action that may result in harm to the organization, the public interest, or health, safety, and the environment, whether intentional or not. They're about as broad as you can possibly get. Intentional, unintentional, harm is internal, harm is external, go for it. That's their approach. Although, I'm jumping to E, I'm going to come back to C in a little bit. Disclosures are not the same as complaints. Whistleblowing is about trying to protect others from harm, including harm to the organization, workforce, public, taxpayers, right, or environment. An individual who is complaining about personal matters, however legitimate, is not blowing the whistle. That's not called blowing the whistle. Now, obviously, there's a little bit of a gray area, right? When you think back to Me Too reporting, right? You're not going to make, I think, at this point, no one's going to make the argument that, well, that's just personal and therefore it doesn't qualify as whistleblowing. But that's the line that they draw in item E. The idea being that, well, let me hold back on that for right now. Other definitions tend to be narrower and I think more realistic. They require that there be a level of intent to justify reporting outside the firm and that there be an element of harm that goes outside of the company. So if you take a look at number four, Ralph Nader, right? One of the most famous, I think, of whistleblowers. Whistleblowing was defined in 1972 by Ralph Nader as, quote, an act of a man or a woman who, believing in the public interest, overrides the interest of the organization he serves, publicly blows the whistle if the organization is involved in corrupt, illegal, fraudulent, or harmful activity. The definition has undergone some debate since then, but whistleblowing is now generally accepted as an act by a person or group to disclose to authorities or to the public acts acts of significant wrongdoing. The wrongdoing may relate to a violation of the law, unethical activities, health and safety violations, or other matters which pose a risk or danger to public health, safety, or interest. So they want to see that it's about public interest. It's not the health of the organization. And they specify corrupt, illegal, fraudulent, harmful. It really seems to imply a level of intent that's involved. I mean, you could argue harmful is not necessarily.
One that doesn't belong in the list.
Understood. Yeah. Understood. But generally speaking, that's what you see. Mitch?
But we're leaving it up to the discretion of the whistleblower to determine if it is in fact meets these definitions, right? And the reverse harm, of course, can happen if that person is wrong.
Correct. And so that's where marketers of whistleblower systems come in. And they suggest that you have some kind of system for hearing reports and vetting them. But if the person has reached the stage of going outside the company, then, you know, lots of luck.
Right.
If you take a look at number five, Professor McAvoy, actually looking at the time, I'm going to skip it, but you can see it also, you can see it there. He also takes this this kind of approach. And the other point, though, beyond the question of what type of wrongdoing and who the victim is that you have to be capable of leading to change, driving change by making this report. So back in number three, item C, whistleblowing means reporting concerns to people or entities who are believed to be in a position to take action. That's also seen in McAvoy in number five. And it's also seen number six, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine, in many ways the dean of Jewish business ethics until he passed away several years ago, quotes a professor, Richard DeGeorge, "The employee must have good reasons to believe that by going public, the necessary changes will be brought about." And there in number seven, by the way, you see Sandy Boucher, who I mentioned earlier, the one who talked about the importance of whistleblowing reports. So that's you can go to the link there and see it. So bottom line is, we're talking about protecting a victim, we're talking about going outside the normal chain of command, and we're talking about making change, not only broadcasting guilt. Now, there is a history of whistleblowing in Judaism as well. And I don't mean people not minding their business. I mean, like, as an issue within Judaism. I tried to think of a case of successful whistleblowing in Tanakh. And there I couldn't really think of a successful one. Meaning, you have informants who tell a person who is directly in the line of fire, so to speak. So if you think of the Purim story, Purim's coming up, right? So Mordecai learns that there's a plot against King Ahasuerus, and he tells Esther, who tells the king, but that's not really whistleblowing. Right? It doesn't feel like it's just a direct piece of information about, you know, someone wants to hurt you. Gedaliah, the governor of Israel after the Babylonians destroy the first Beis HaMikdash, the first temple. So again, there's a plot against him, an assassination plot, and he is informed, and he of course doesn't listen, and he gets killed. But again, I'm not sure that quite works. The case... Oh, that's an interesting one, right, from last week's Torah portion. The Jews get out of Egypt, right, the slaves have fled, and somebody tells the Pharaoh, hey, the Jews have fled. That's an interesting example, potentially, of whistleblowing. I came up with one that I thought actually works really well as a parallel to some of the cases that come up today. Unfortunately, it was an unsuccessful case, and that's the case of Hophni and Pinchas, the sons of Shmuel, of Eli. Right? The story in the beginning of the book of Shmuel, Eli is the Kohen Gadol, he's the high priest. He is already very old. It's unclear exactly how old at this point in the story, but he dies at the age of, I think, 96, if I remember correctly. And his sons have taken over the operations of the Mishkan, of the tabernacle, and they are abusing their power there. There's some debate as to exactly what it is that's being done wrong. Allegations range from holding up people's sacrifices so that they can take for themselves before anybody else gets, some level of abuse of the women who were bringing sacrifices at the tabernacle. And messages come to this Kohen Gadol, the high priest, Eli, about what his sons are doing, and he doesn't act on it. And in the end, he gets punished horribly for his failure to act on the warnings that he received. Yeah.
Speaking on Teresh, count as...
So that was what I said about Mordecai, right?
Oh, I thought you were talking... Oh, I thought you were...
I was thinking that at the overall plot, not...
Oh, you meant the plot against the Jews in the Megillah. Right, no, I was thinking
that was the original one. Okay.
Got it. So yes, I hear the point about the Jewish part of that story as well. I was thinking Bigdan and Teresh. Yeah?
Halakhically, whistleblowing, is there an issue of Vayis Hashem Ra or Lashon
Hara? Absolutely, and that's part of where we're going to have to go with this. The concern for the effect of one's speech on others is very strong here. Even without a case history in Tanakh, our duty to rebuke, the duty that we have to rebuke directly, meaning I know someone is doing something wrong, I have to try to correct them, is a biblical obligation, as we are going to discuss. But we have a long history of people engaging in public whistleblowing, right? You have what's called the cherem, right, being instituted by a court. When somebody's behavior is inappropriate and is reported to a Beit Din, depending on the gravity of what's being done, the Beit Din might issue a decree which orders people not to engage in business with that person, which tries to ostracize the person effectively until they get in line, until they do what they're supposed to do, and the penalties, you know, can be pretty severe in that regard. Or the phenomenon of the Pashkevil. Right, what's a Pashkevil? Right. Posters tend to be on the wall in Bnei Brak, in Mea Shearim. Those are where they tend to be seen today. But it's an old practice of publishing a broadside, right, on walls of buildings without your name, but complaining about that which you see that's being done that is wrong. Take a look at source number 8. Very interesting article. I think Rabbi Ziering had pointed this out to me a couple of years ago. Shaming in Judaism, past, present, future. In cases where communal authority did not provide the tools for the rabbinical court to punish the transgressor, or when, for whatever reason, the leaders did not want to impose such harsh punishments as excommunication, we find a further practice of public shaming, particularly within the ultra-Orthodox community, that involved a print communications medium, the Pashkevil, wall poster. Shaming via Pashkevilim was carried out in the spirit of the edict, publicized the flatterers before a defamation of God's name. Meaning, prevent the defamation by publicizing the wrongdoer. The stress here is on sins committed secretly or on people who pretend to be righteous, and the disclosure is designed to warn the public about their actions. The Yiddish word Pashkevil derives from the name of a citizen of Rome. Never would have guessed that. By the name of Pasquino, I think, or something like that, who used to hang satires and critical comments about the Pope on the pedestal of a headless statue. His name was eventually given to the statue and then to the square where the statue stood. The initiative taken by one individual evolved into a common practice whereby citizens hung anonymous vilifying signs around the city. The phenomenon spread throughout Western Europe during the 16th century as this channel began to accompany religious and social struggles. So that's where the practice comes from. It comes from Rome in the 16th century, but it's been controversial. There's a biblical verse, Arur Makei Re'ehu Basaser. Cursed is the one who strikes another person in secret. Look what Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, better known as the Chafetz Chaim, had to say about this practice of the Pashkevil. I'm going to stick with reading aloud my English translation in the interests of time. He says, and some say, one who speaks harmfully is like one who has been bitten by a rabid dog, in that he also barks inaudibly, for with his harmful speech, he causes harm in secret. And especially those who write amal, called Pashkevilin, regarding whom it says, cursed is the one who strikes his fellow in secret. The Chafetz Chaim was very against the Pashkevil practice. He did not like this idea of anonymous reporting. So when is this allowed? When is it appropriate? When is it actually required? Yeah.
Whistleblower has sort of a positive intent, but if you're the person that gets it done, you can start calling an informant.
Yes.
I think it goes...
Yes. Absolutely true. It's all in the eye of the beholder.
Yes.
Absolutely. This is true. So the calculation of whether and when to blow the whistle and how to do it is based on that which we spent the last 28 minutes outlining. Within the secular system, the argument in favor of reporting is fundamentally about the public interest, although it can help the business itself directly and indirectly. I brought you the CPA Act in number 10. every person engaged in the administration of this act and the bylaws shall preserve secrecy respecting information or material that comes to his or her knowledge or possession in the course of his or her duties, shall not disclose any such information or material to any person except, and one of the exceptions is, if there are reasonable grounds for believing that there is a significant risk of harm, doesn't define harm, physical harm, financial harm, doesn't say, to any person if the disclosure is not made, and that making the disclosure is likely to reduce the risk. So it's to prevent harm, and likely your report is actually going to prevent that risk. That's the most basic reason to disclose, but it can also help the business itself directly by correcting problems. Right? If something is wrong within the business, you're helping the business by correcting it. You're also potentially helping them indirectly, because if you don't report it, and then it comes out in a worse way later on, right? That's something you could have diffused by taking care of it earlier in the game. Also, there's something called a kitam, I don't know if I'm pronouncing that right, lawsuit, am I pronouncing that right? My Latin's not great? I am pronouncing it. Okay, good, thank you. If you take a look, it's source number 11. From Canadian lawyer. Most tips come from California, followed by New York and Florida. Let's talk about tips to the SEC about illegality. The SEC received 62 tips from Canadians, Gray says, making it the second most active country behind the UK. That was up from 46 Canadian tips last year. Good job. But it's not just Dodd-Frank and Sarbanes that can trip Canadian companies up when it comes to whistleblowers. Gray notes there's also the U.S. False Claims Act, which allows whistleblowers to file what's called a kitam lawsuit against a party that has financially defrauded the federal government. Right? People are familiar with this? The whistleblower, in American law, is able to file suits against the wrongdoer in a case where the government is being defrauded. So in other words, the government doesn't have to bring the suit. The whistleblower brings the lawsuit, and effectively it's on behalf of the federal government. But the way it works is only the government gets access to the filing. It's a whole thing. It's fascinating. But the result is that in the event that the whistleblower wins the lawsuit, the whistleblower gets a payout from the case. Yes, from the government, effectively.
The Ontario Human Rights Tribunals.
Yeah.
They find a whistleblower, and that whistleblower gets paid, even though he wasn't necessarily involved in what AVLA there was.
Really? That I didn't know about.
That's why it's corrupt.
Okay.
Ontario Securities and Exchange Commission about 4 years ago implemented a whistleblower reward, and it incentivizes someone to come forward and expose wrongdoing. But the reward is only given if there's a successful conviction. Mm-hmm. Which, once you go through civil litigation, et cetera, that's 4 or 5 years down the road.
Right.
And by that time, the whistleblower is done. Right. Mm-hmm. They've lost their job, they've lost their home, they've lost their marriage, they've lost everything. So while they crawled it as a great step forward in transparency within the stock exchange, it nevertheless is really only window dressing because it's not an incentive for someone to come forward.
Got it.
I'm sorry? It starts off as civil, but depending upon what the nature of the disclosure is, it could lead into criminal. The point is they put it in to incentivize people to come forward with a reward.
Right.
But by the time that reward may be forthcoming to that individual will never work again. That individual has probably lost their home, lost all their life savings, and is probably would not want to do it. So the notion of putting in an incentive, a financial incentive, to bring people forward, I think,
Right. So just to repeat that just very briefly, because I'm not sure everyone on the recording would have heard from that end of the table. The Ontario SEC has put in about 4 years ago, you said, an incentive, financial incentive for whistleblowers if their report leads to a conviction. So that means that it's delayed until they actually have the conviction. And in the interim, they can suffer whatever consequences of the whistleblowing happen to them, and they may receive this reward in the end.
But I think, and this hasn't been raised, we're talking in professional capacity, people take an oath.
Right.
You're a lawyer with a doctor, right? And when you connect one's obligation to come forward and you connect it to the oath, I think that's where you get more incentive for people to act appropriately than if you do try to
accountants don't have an oath.
They have the act.
They have the act, correct.
Right.
Right.
Granted, they don't take an oath, but they do have a duty and a responsibility.
Right.
Right.
Right. I hear that.
There's a bit of a wrinkle on this. I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Oftentimes, particularly in a potentially new situation, we are asked to sign a non-disclosure agreement. So how? What are the implications of signing an NDA if after the fact you find, at least do we have to amend our NDAs to include clauses that talk to this type of...
So I think if I understand the law correctly, the NDA is inferior to this requirement. Meaning you can't, in the same way that in Judaism we say that I can't take an oath which overrides the oath I took at Sinai, right? If I swear that I'm not going to eat matzah on Pesach, my oath is irrelevant. I think the NDA also is is inferior. Yeah. Yeah.
So is there sort of an implication that once you've blown the whistle that you may be a little bit unemployable in the industry?
I mean, I think that's reality.
Show me one whistleblower who has, other than Ralph Nader, who has survived. I don't want to draw the conversation to me, but 2011, I blew the whistle on Orange Air Ambulance as Vice President of Hospital. I was the second in command, and there was hundreds of millions of dollars of fraud and embezzlement. And I spent a year in front of the Legislative Public Accounts Committee testifying as the key witness. And though I was held up as a hero and someone who had the courage to come forward, no one hired me because I was around and I was a snitch. So no one ever let me back in the boardroom again because they felt if I did not agree with the policies going forward or if I found something funny, would I run and snitch them out? So that's why that component in the Securities and Exchange Commission, which offers that financial reward, really doesn't work. Because that's 4 or 5 years down the road. By the time that happens, unless you're independently rich, you've lost everything. And you are unemployed.
Right.
Noble and a snitch at the same time.
Yep.
Yes. And as Jacob said, it all depends on who's... Actually, you said it. It all depends on who is who's looking at it. But, that sounds like a terrible thing to have to go through.
So the person questioning whether they want to bring wrongdoing forward has to go through a myriad of questions themselves. What are they prepared to draw on the line?
Right, right. I hear it. One of the other arguments and on behalf of whistleblowing comes again from that CSA group. And I mention it only because it's so strange to think of it as a justification, but someone clearly is saying it, makes the argument that the psychological health of workers is a justification for whistleblowing. Meaning, if workers are operating within an environment in the company where they know something is being done incorrectly, whether on purpose or not, and nothing is being done about it, that harms them psychologically, and therefore they would be justified in reporting this outside of the firm. I find that to be an overreach. I don't see that.
If you have a sexual harassment going on,
Not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about where they feel like they're operating in a framework in the company where things aren't being done productively. I don't mean a harassment case at all. The arguments against whistleblowing begin with duty to the employer. Right, you have a duty to your employer. I brought you from number 12 from the CPA Code of Professional Conduct. Members and firms have duties to those to whom they provide professional services that arise from the nature of the relationships with the recipients of the services. Members and firms have a professional duty to act with integrity, due care, contractual duty to provide services as defined by the terms of their engagement or employment, .. You have a duty to your employer. That's a reason not to report, or at least to try to do everything within the company. In addition to that, there are practical problems with whistleblowing, and some have sort of leaned towards this already. But if you take a look at number 13, Rabbi Dr. Aaron Levine points out that if you have employees reporting things, you can create an unhealthy work environment. Nor is it clear that asking employees to act in that capacity would make for a productive corporate atmosphere. Such a requirement would turn a normal society into a police state or cultivate a police state mentality among its citizens. Not to mention, as was noted earlier, they may not know what they're looking at. You have somebody who's in one department who sees something funny and says, I think this is wrong, I'm going to go report it, and just doesn't understand, because it's not their department. They're not familiar with the workings, and they make a report and create a lot of trouble without, you know, just because they didn't really understand what was going on. I'm going to take one question, but then we're almost at 40 minutes, and we haven't really done enough of the Jewish stuff for me to feel like I'm adding something here. Yes.
I'll wait.
Okay. So from a that's from a secular perspective. We've seen reasons to report, right? The victim, potentially the good of the company, directly or indirectly as well. We've seen reasons not to report, and that's in terms of your duty to the employer and the practical problems that can come up with whistleblowing, the unhealthy work environment, the possibility that you get it wrong. Within halacha, some of this is going to mirror the secular system, but then there are added religious elements. In terms of reasons to report, so there's a very clear duty to the victim within Judaism. In source number 14, I brought you the classic Gemara in Sanhedrin. How do you know that if you see somebody drowning in a river, being dragged by a beast, attacked by bandits, you have to act to save that person? The Torah says, you shall not stand by as your peer's blood is shed. Lo sa'amod al dam reyecha. That's a basic biblical obligation. That applies where the harm is physical. You can see that based on the examples brought in the passage from the Talmud of number 14. But then look at number 15, right? Moses Maimonides, when he codifies this mitzvah in his collection of mitzvot, he codifies this mitzvah of not standing by. He says, when we see that someone is in danger of death or hefseg, loss, and we are capable of rescue. In other words, I have a duty to step in to protect people from financial harm as well. There's actually some debate as to whether this was truly Maimonides' position, whether the Rambam really held that. The Rambam's language in Hilchos Rotzeach, the first chapter of the laws of murder, is a little bit different. Nonetheless, the tendency of many halachic authorities, including the Chafetz Chaim, is to say that yes, lo samod al dam reyecha, do not stand by while someone's blood is shed, includes preventing financial harm for them. So that's number one. Number two, there, even if you didn't like applying that verse to financial harm, there's a mitzvah called Hashavas Aveda. I have a mitzvah of restoring to people their lost property. So if I have a mitzvah of restoring lost property to people, certainly I have a mitzvah of preventing them from losing the property in the first place. I should have to act in order to avoid that. So that's second. Number three, in terms of my duty to the company, I absolutely have an obligation to be a good employee in Jewish law, and this is expressed in many different ways in the Torah and in Jewish law. But for example, an employee is required to use all of the time that is billed for service of the employer or for service of the client, right? You may be familiar with the passage in the Talmud that discusses the Birkat HaMazon, blessing after meals. You know that after a person eats, they're supposed to recite a bracha, a blessing. There are actually four parts to it. The first three are biblical obligations. The fourth one is rabbinic. And the Gemara says that if you are being paid, let's say, to harvest in somebody's field, you skip that fourth part of Birkat HaMazon. You skip the fourth part because that's a rabbinic obligation and you have a duty to your employer. Granted that today, in today's work environment, they have things called breaks and you're allowed to take a little bit of time. But in the Talmudic times, that wasn't so, and your obligation to your employer came first. The halacha is that an employee is not allowed to take on extra jobs that will affect their ability to serve their primary employer. Those who were there, a couple of people here might have been there when I did a class at Zeifman's several months ago on moonlighting. Yes. And the question of taking on extra work that might diminish the quality of the work done to the primary employer. That's a very serious issue. So I have a duty to be a good employee. And remember, we've said that reporting can actually help the firm. It can also hurt. Don't kid yourself, but it can help. Those are halachic obligations that mirror the secular ones, the duty to the victim and the duty to the firm. However, there are two added religious elements in Jewish law that I don't think you really have in secular law. Number one, the duty to the criminal. We have a mitzvah within Judaism that says that if you see somebody doing something wrong, you have an obligation to help correct their conduct. This is actually understood as a mitzvah not for God's sake, but for the sake of the criminal. Meaning that I am helping them by instructing them. I brought you a passage from the Talmud which discusses this and asks the question of just how far you have to go with this mitzvah, which in Hebrew is called tochacha. I'm not going to be going into the specifics and the ins and outs of whether you hit the person or not hit the person. We're not hitting people today. But the point is, if someone is doing something wrong, I actually have a duty to them to help them do right. And in addition to that, I have a duty to God. Several times in the Torah says, "Uvi'arta harami kirbecha," you shall eliminate evil from your midst. And based on that, the Rush makes a very interesting comment. Rabbeinu Asher, major authority in Jewish law, and I quote him here in number 17. The context for his comment is an interesting one. The Talmud is talking about something that at first blush has nothing to do with our discussion right now. It's talking about laws of witnesses. You know that in Jewish law, a Beit Din, a rabbinical court, hears testimony from a set of two witnesses. Those witnesses may not be related to each other. Question comes up. Two brothers see a murder take place. Are they able to testify, or are they automatically one set, and therefore they're disqualified because they are related to each other? And that's the Talmud's question. And the Talmud asks, if you're really serious about that, then what should two brothers do if they witness a murder? Like, you're going to tell me, really, now we have no witnesses just because these two who saw it together are related to each other, someone's going to now get off as a result of that. So Rabbeinu Asher comments on that in source number 17. And he says, well, maybe yeah. Maybe there's nothing they can do about it. Maybe that's really the rule. He says, no. He says, can't be. Why? Anyone who sees impropriety is obligated to testify, fulfilling the biblical verse, you shall eradicate evil from your midst. And this is quoted by the Beis Yosef of Yosef Cairo. There's an obligation. I have a religious obligation to get rid of wrongdoing. So I now have four reasons from a Jewish law perspective to report. Duty to the victim. Duty to the company, where reporting will help the company. Duty to the person who is committing the wrongdoing. And duty to God. However,
is there a difference between Jews or non-Jews?
In what regard? In terms of duty to the victim?
Yeah.
No, I have a duty to non-Jews as well.
Duty to the criminal.
The duty to... Sorry. In terms of Ubiyarta Rami Kirbecha, eradicating evil from your midst, it's about your community. It doesn't matter who's... Yeah. Yeah. And I there's more to say about the duty to the victim and which ways Jews and non-Jews, but I don't... we're not going to have time here.
Is there shash still? Let's not...
So, one of the areas that I really wanted to discuss, but I realized there's no time to really do it, is the issue of Mesira. What if it's a Jew who's engaged in it, and now you're going to turn him over to the authorities, and what they do will be inappropriate, and what a rabbinical court would have done would have been different, but it's just beyond the scope of what we're going to be able to get to. So, Jewish law also has reasons not to report. Number one, we've already noted you have to work hard for your employer, and potentially this could damage the employer. Number two, there is the issue that was mentioned before of prohibited speech. We have prohibitions against rechilus and lashon hara. Rechilus is the prohibition against sharing information about somebody, disclosing that person's information to others. Even when the information is true, I'm not allowed to go tale-bearing, is the prohibition. And I'm also not allowed to speak in a way that can be harmful to somebody else. That includes testifying in court where my testimony is not going to make a difference. I brought you source number 18, which talks about three types of behavior that God rejects, and one of them is a person who witnesses impropriety and testifies alone. And the idea of testifying alone means because there's no second witness, it's not actually going to have any sort of impact. And therefore, it is prohibited. I scrambled my sources a bit here on the sheet. I'm not sure why. But 19 and 20 go back to the point about rechilus, about sharing somebody else's private information, that prohibition. Whereas 18 is really about this issue of testifying alone and the concern for lashon hara. 21 goes back to where 18 was and also is about this concern for lashon hara, this concern for harmful speech, I'm going to skip it because it doesn't add to what we've been saying, and instead point you to source number 22, which I really should have known when I was back in school. How many of us have been in a case in which the teacher recognizes something was done wrong in the class, but doesn't know who did it, right? I remember in grade 10, where somebody threw a snapper, right, in the classroom, and the teacher was very upset and wanted to know, so who is it who threw this? Never found out. But take a look at number 22, Rabbi Moshe Feinstein's ruling on this. This is actually his second ruling, because he issued a ruling and somebody wrote to him and didn't like his first ruling, and he says, no, I'm going to tell you why I'm right. He says, I will explain what I wrote earlier, that it is ugly for a teacher to tell students that if someone knows who did the disgraceful deed, he should inform on him, causing them to take lashon hara lightly. He says, it's an ugly thing to do because you teach the students to disclose negative information about others. Your Honor, the person who wrote to Rabbi Feinstein, and those with you were troubled when I wrote that. For the teacher seeks to influence the student not to repeat the disgraceful deed. In other words, but you're trying to do a good thing. You're the teacher. You're trying to teach them right behavior. Further, if the student will know that the teacher knows his deeds, he'll refrain from doing it again. He says, I wrote there that the permission for the sake of altruistic rebuke, like the case of Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, a passage in the Talmud, is only relevant where the informant arouses himself to tell the teacher so that he might rebuke. But not that the teacher decree upon his students to tell him something negative about one of them. In other words, if a student comes to the teacher and says, I feel bad, I'm reporting this for the right reasons because I want to help, that's a different story. But for the teacher to say to the class, I want you to tell me, is an inspiration for wrongdoing for them. When he instructs them to reveal it, it is as though he makes the most severe prohibition against lashon hara, against harmful speech, light for them. So he doesn't like teachers putting that kind of a message out to the class. So there's a concern for prohibited speech, and there's also the concern about embarrassing others in public. The Talmud compares embarrassing somebody else in public to murder. I brought you in number 23. The class of people who descend to Gehenna, to hell, and never come out. They include somebody who embarrasses somebody else in public, so much so that Maimonides rules that if somebody embarrasses somebody else in public, the courts are able to fine such a person. You're not allowed to engage in shaming people in public. There's more in number 25. I'm just jumping because of time. But out of all of this, we see that within Jewish law, we have major reasons to report, right? Duty to the victim, duty to the company, duty to the criminal, duty to God. But we also have this serious concern within Jewish law. My duty to the employer, my duty to avoid prohibited speech, my duty not to shame others in public. So what do you do? Where does this all leave us in terms of practical guidance? So CPA Ontario really wants everything dealt with in-house, other than in a case of clear harm to the public. They want the up-the-ladder principle, which I brought you here from Professor McAvoy in source number 26. And the idea is relatively straightforward. It's you go up the chain of command until you get to the top of the company, and if you still can't get where you need to go, then you resign the engagement. Take a look at source number 27 from the preamble to the CPA code. If the matter remains unresolved, the member should consult with other appropriate persons within the firm or employing organization for help in obtaining resolution. Right, this is going up the ladder. Where a matter involves a conflict with or within a firm or an employing organization, a member should also consider consulting with those charged with governance of the organization, board of directors, audit committee. If, after exhausting all relevant possibilities, the ethical conflict remains unresolved, the member or firm should, where ethically possible, refuse to remain associated with the matter creating the conflict. Walk away. That's what they would prefer that one do, and I brought it for you in number 28. They're talking about dealing with a suspected misstatement by the firm, and I'm jumping to number 7 within 28. What do they want you to do? Take the steps that are necessary to ensure the financial statements are not misleading, or issue a report with an appropriate reservation that's within the firm, or resign from the engagement in accordance with appropriate statutory requirements. That's what they would like you to do. And it's seen in the case that I mentioned in number 29, which I didn't bring you the actual case on the sheet, but I'll explain it. The story. This is meant as a teaching example. So they say, I started a new job last year with great salary and perks. It seemed too good to be true. It was. I should have realized that the turnover for my job was unusually high. I'm the fourth controller in 2 years. The president of the company is pressuring me to turn a blind eye to his personal expenses being recorded as expenses in financial statements and tax returns. The amounts are material. I don't want to lose my job or my designation. What should I do? Signed, pressured in Peterborough. And their answer includes the following. Your professional designation opens many doors for you, but it also means in situations like the one you have described, you likely need to make some tough decisions, such as whether to quit your job if you want to keep your designation. Determine whether there is a higher level of management or a board of directors or internal legal counsel with whom you can discuss this matter. Your options may be limited if the president is the owner of the company, in which case you should consider resigning. That's the instruction. Only in the statute that we saw earlier did we say if there's harm to society, then report outside of the firm. But otherwise, CPA Ontario does not want you going outside of the firm. Within halacha, within Jewish law, so we are taught to put the victim first. Lo samod al dam reyacha, do not stand by as somebody's blood is shed, comes first. Yes, it should be in-house first. However, the victim ultimately comes first. Rabbi Avadi Yosef notes this in source number 30, the passage in the Torah that talks about rechilus, about not spreading stories, spreading other people's information, is juxtaposed with do not stand by while somebody's blood is shed. And so he says, don't go as a peddler among your nation, but you're still not allowed to stand by, meaning you may have to violate that in order to protect victims. If you take a look at source number 31, that's a...
That's a guy who's doing the wrong thing.
Yes.
So it's not to the company, it's to the person who's doing the wrong thing.
That's his information that you are disclosing.
Right.
Yes. In number 31, this is a classic source that I just summarized. The Chafetz Chaim, Rabbi Yisrael Meir Kagan, gives you rules about speaking harmfully about others when necessary in order to protect the victim. And he says, you can only report personal experience or a verified account. It can't be hearsay. Don't jump to conclusions about what happened and what laws were broken. You have to know that what you're reporting is true. See if there is another way to avoid harm besides public disclosure. Stick to the fact. Do not magnify the crime beyond its true nature and circumstances. Right? You always want to be believed, so you want people to act on it, so you blow it up a little bit. Don't do that. There must be no personal agenda, only the altruistic goal of protecting the community and righting the wrong. And make sure the harm you cause to the subject is commensurate with the wrongdoing. If this is somebody who cheated on a $10 thing and now he's going to lose his job, ask yourself whether that's really the appropriate thing to do. You can make the argument for it that the $10 thing is going to lead to a $100 thing, which is going to lead somewhere else. I understand that. But you have to make sure that it's really justified. Interestingly, the Law Society of Ontario, in their Rules of Professional Conduct, Rule 3.3-3, actually has a very similar list of things that you have to watch out for. But that's the principle that's involved. Jewish law is much more biased towards reporting externally than you will see in the rules for CPI Ontario. Miriam.
So is there a lot of concern that if you go up the chain of command that what you might do is, you know, you're asking someone and what you're doing is alerting them so that they push the wrongdoing underground? It's risky.
Maybe
they'll be
it is risky.
That's possible. Oh, I didn't understand that. Okay, makes sense. Or they could be, now they know, I've got to do it differently and I've got to hide what I've done. And then you may not have a chance or anybody have a chance of disclosing.
Right. But this is not necessarily that you won't have a chance to disclose it. It all depends on how you've been handling the case. In other words, it's true that by reporting it up the chain of command, you open up the possibility that people who are in power are able to cover up that which happened. However, you also have the obligation to the company that's going to require that you go that route. So my suggestion would be document everything that can be documented before someone is going to have a chance to cover it up. And you'll know, if they don't take care of this, and in fact they try to cover it up, that means I do have to go elsewhere with it. or disengage. I'm sorry, I just want to make sure to at least touch on the anonymous whistleblowing. And also, I'll stay at the end, but I don't like holding people past the time that's been stated. So, in terms of the anonymous whistleblowing, you have two kinds. One is going to the external authority, the police, the media, and the other is going to an authority within the company, but doing it anonymously. So there are clear benefits in giving the whistleblower confidence in her own safety, that's for sure. But you have two problems in the secular system. Problem number one is you really do risk hurting the employer. McAvoy points that out in number 32. It also raises questions about the motivation, right? Am I trying to hurt, to fix the problem or hurt the organization when I insist on being anonymous? It looks like I'm just trying to hurt the organization because I'm not willing to be engaged in fixing the problem, right? Go back to what we said from the Chafetz Chaim, right, with his line about the Pashkevilin and people who strike each other in secret. It looks like you're just trying to harm the other. That's one problem. A second problem is you need to be able to make change. But it's hard to make change if you are doing this anonymously. Because as was noted, I think Mitch said it, you can't really investigate properly if the person who's reporting it is anonymous. And also, as was also noted, there's no accountability if a person is anonymous. And that lowers the bar, as Miriam said before, for reporting. Because if you know that, you can't be held accountable, right? Anonymous comments, it's very dangerous. Also, from a halachic perspective, if you're trying to fulfill your obligation to the wrongdoer of tochacha, of rebuke, who accepts rebuke that's given anonymously? Right? No one ever accepts anonymous rebuke. I can't resist the story. Forgive me, but I'll tell it to you. The story about the rabbi who gets up in his on Shabbos morning to speak. Not the rabbi here, Chas v'Shalom. Don't please. And a rabbi is somewhere in some community. Gets up to speak Shabbos morning, and he says, you know, I have frequently received, you know, letters from people where they refuse to sign their name, right? Where they have some complaint about something and they don't sign their name at the bottom. But I've never seen this before. A letter where somebody only signs his name and doesn't write anything else, and he holds it up. Someone had written jerk. That's anonymous whistleblowing. So, in any case, former Shul Rabbi. But the fundamental problem is that rebuke that is anonymous is very unlikely to succeed. And so you haven't really fulfilled what you were trying to fulfill halachically. And so for all of these reasons, we really don't favor the anonymous whistleblowing route. Granted that, if that's the only way to protect the public from serious harm, and that's really the only way because you won't survive making the report, we're talking about something on that level, then maybe that breaks the rules. But otherwise, it's really something that I think halacha, as well as secular process, would not approve of. So I'm going to stay for questions and comments and discussion, but if anyone has to leave, it's fine. Please make sure you signed in, especially those who came in late. Thank you very much. Right, that was, Jacob had said, the Gilgal Esther one. Yes, Jonathan.
From a halachic point of view, is it better to find in the business practice that they're expensing personal expenses or travel, whatever it's not? Is it better from another point of view just to whistleblow on the practice itself without naming the i.e. if it's not limited to specific individuals, etc.? So that way you're just basically whistleblowing on the practice as opposed to the personalities who are doing the practice, as opposed to...
Well, will you achieve your results?
That's actually the question.
If you'll achieve the results...
It's just better to do that before you
do it personal. I would think so. Any time that you can do this without disclosing things that don't need to be disclosed, you achieve the end.
Right.
Yeah, I would think that'll be worthwhile. Mary, you were going to say?
So, in a bigger firm, having a proper human resources department. Can that alleviate some of the problems where, or is it the human resources department basically reporting to management, and they won't ever be able to be impartial and
right? So I would say it can be done right. I don't know that it is done right.
We've got a
you know?
So there's always caution, whoever you're saying.
Realistically, yeah.
Just as a practical, you've got to talk